and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for December 18th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the 2009 Science Breakthrough of the Year, the Nine Runners-Up, and the 2009 Virus of the Year, the novel H1N1 influenza.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Each year, the Science News team puts together a special section on the scientific breakthroughs of the year, which you can read all about in the magazine or on our website at www.sciencemag.org/BTOY2009. There, you can also see a video about the breakthrough of the year, Ardipithecus remedus, or ARDI, which we'll also get to at the end of the show. But to start us off, this year the news team decided to highlight a virus of the year, too, and picked the novel H1N1 influenza. Scientists agree that the best way to stop influenza is with a vaccine, but what this pandemic influenza has illustrated is just how difficult it is to race the virus when making a new vaccine for a novel strain. Now, the vaccine did make it to many people, but, for example, in North America, it often arrived too late to do any good. I spoke with John Cohen, who co-authored a piece about the virus, in this week's special section.
I think the novel H1N1 influenza virus will go down more in history for causing confusion than catastrophe. A lot of people expected that the pandemic that would hit us next would be like bird flu, which kills about 50-60% of the people that it infects. And the new H1N1 doesn't kill many more people than seasonal flu. What it does do is target unusual groups, young people, pregnant women. And so the impact certainly is severe, but many people planned for the worst when it came to a pandemic, and this isn't that pandemic.
Why so much confusion?
In part because of what people expected. They thought a pandemic would start in Asia and move from there. This one started in North America. They anticipated that the virus would overwhelm hospitals, that it would lead to massive economic problems. These things just didn't materialize. They didn't happen. And it was also unclear in the beginning just how deadly it was. In the first reports out of Mexico, it seemed much deadlier.
Now, we're not done with pandemic H1N1. All lessons learned, or at least perhaps all lessons identified to be learned regarding pandemic influenza?
Well, I think the rule about influenza that the influenza gurus love to say over and over again is that influenza is unpredictable. This virus has an ability to change that is unbelievable. It's very different from other viruses. It both can mutate in the way that all viruses do, but it also can reassort, which means it can actually kind of mate with another influenza virus and pick up a whole gene from it. And it's the possibility that this virus will change into something deadlier that really strikes fear in the heart of influenza experts. But I think at this point, the way most people are looking at this virus is a wake-up call. It could have been much worse. We see the weaknesses in our system, and maybe we can prepare better for the real thing, for that really nasty 1918-like pandemic that still may occur in the future, whether it's a mutant version of this virus or something completely different.
John Cohen talking about this year's novel H1N1 Influenza, Science Magazine's 2009 Virus of the Year. Now to discuss three runner-up breakthroughs of the year in the life sciences, news writer Elizabeth Panisi joins us. First up, Elizabeth, let's talk about the breakthrough you wrote about on plant ABA receptors.
Well, first, ABA is a hormone, a plant hormone that's very important in helping the plant respond to stress. When there's not enough water or other problems, ABA will cause the plant to slow its growth down. It will make seeds dormant. So it's a protective chemical in the plant. And for many years, scientists have tried to figure out, well, what does the ABA do? And to understand that, they need to find what molecules ABA interacts with. In other words, find the ABA receptors.
So how it actually goes about helping the plant survive when there are times of stress.
That's right. And there have been some false alarms where people have thought they've found the ABA receptors and they turned out not to be the right molecules. But this May, two teams working independently came upon the same group of proteins that seemed to be the right ones.
Does this have any implications for the genetically modified plant crowd?
Not directly. I mean, what's good about finding the ABA receptors is that it sort of lets you figure out more about the pathway, the stress response pathways, which gives you more places that you might be able to interfere or enhance the stress responses. But in terms of doing genetic modification of plants, it doesn't have a direct effect. So this is a beginning step, and knowing the ABA receptor and other research this year found what the structure of the ABA receptor is linked to ABA and also linked to other molecules will help us figure out how to make use of that pathway to help plants survive stress better.
Okay. So next, rapamycin, which performs a similar function in animals, helping them live longer. How exactly does it work? What's the breakthrough?
Nobody knows how exactly it works. But the breakthrough is to show that you can have a substance that actually makes mammals live longer. Now, there's a lot of work on aging, trying to understand what prolongs lifespan. Some of the key work tends to be related to calorie restriction. And actually, this year, there were some important results from some long-term studies of monkeys on calorie restriction. The idea is that calorie restriction somehow prolongs life, and it seems in these monkeys, which have been studied now for 20 years, that is proving to be the case. Now, rapamycin is a chemical. It's actually secreted by bacteria, soil bacteria, and it's been used as a drug to treat cancer, certain cancers, and also to prevent immune system rejection of transplant organs. But there have been some evidence or some suggestions that it might have a life-prolonging effect. So there were several groups that have been testing rapamycin in mice. They gave the mice who were 600 days old, that means about 60 people years, and saw that the mice on the rapamycin-supplemented diet lived 9 to 14% longer than mice not on that diet. So the suggestion is somehow rapamycin does prolong life, but how is not known right now.
I imagine rapamycin won't be something that makes it into the supplemental market because it does sort of undermine the immune system.
Right. It's not likely that anybody will want to take rapamycin supplements anytime soon. But it's a new discovery that will help us figure out the mechanisms of aging. It gives us something tangible to work with.
Okay. And finally, gene therapy returns. What had happened to gene therapy and why has it made a comeback?
Well, gene therapy was one of these wonder things that everybody thought was going to solve all of our problems and cure lots of diseases, and it just didn't work out that way. The first gene therapy trials were in the 1990s, and they just didn't work. But this year, there's been several trials in several different diseases where they've had good progress, and so it gives people cause for optimism again.
What particular diseases have researchers been focusing on?
So right now, gene therapy is being used to correct a single gene disorder where there's one gene that's defective, and if you fix that gene, then you fix the problem. So an example of that is a rare form of inherited blindness called Leber's congenital amaurosis. And in both the U.S. and the United Kingdom, researchers injected one eye of patients with this disease with a virus that carried the gene for an enzyme that's needed to make a light-sensing pigment. And in the first trial, all of the light sensitivity of all the partially blind people improved. Some of it improved enough that they were able to do sports and not need learning aids anymore. Another example, X-linked adrenoleukodystrophy, which is a brain disorder, and it kills boys often before they're teenagers. What it is, it's because of the defective gene, the sheath around the nerves is not maintained properly. And so in this case, a French team put a corrective gene into the blood cells of 2 7-year-old boys with this disease. The cells started making the protein, and now 2 years later, the progression of the disease has stopped. So that's cause for optimism. And finally, there was a sort of a update on a study done on the bubble boy disease, which is the severe combined immunodeficiency disorder. And Italian researchers have an 8-year-old trial ongoing, and 8 of the 10 patients no longer need the enzyme replacement therapy and are living normal lives.
So 10 breakthroughs of the year, 3 of them are biology related.
It's not enough.
Not enough? Okay. Elizabeth Panisi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are 6 physical sciences runner-up breakthroughs this year, and Robert Kuntz, deputy news editor for Physical Sciences, joins us now to talk about those 6 other runners-up. And we start with the LINAC Coherent Light Source, or LCLS, at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center in Menlo Park, California. Robert, what does the LCLS do, and why is it a breakthrough this year?
The LCLS is a big machine. It's the world's first X-ray laser. X-rays are very high-energy light, and they're made at SLAC by a particle accelerator which shoots electrons at a target, and X-rays come out.
How much brighter is this than previous light sources?
It is 1 billion times brighter than the previous X-ray light source.
And what are scientists hoping to image with this?
Oh, they could do all kinds of things. They don't know all the things they can do with it yet. One thing that X-ray sources have been used for in the past is getting structures of molecules, of crystals. You bombard these things and you look at how they scatter and you can see how these molecules are made. So LCLS will be good for that, but it'll be good for other things too. One feature of this is that a lot of these pulses are extremely fast, so that you can use them to take snapshots of things like chemical reactions in progress, watching the molecules actually recombine in a way that they've never been able to do before. Another really neat thing about this, I mean, this is kind of a geeky, techie toy breakthrough. It took them 3 years to build this thing. Then they started it up, and it worked right out of the box. They started up in a couple of hours, worked right away. Unlike certain other large physics machines that you might have heard of, this one, they turned it on, and it worked. And I think that constitutes a breakthrough all in itself.
Okay. Well, speaking of imaging really tiny things, let's turn to the next breakthrough here, monopoles. Now, unlike magnets with 2 poles, a north and a south pole, as we say, these are single-poled. Have scientists actually seen one of these, or what's the breakthrough here?
Okay. Well, the monopoles that most people have probably heard about, magnetic monopoles, are like little magnets with only 1 pole, only north or south. And most magnets you know of have both. But theories of physics predict that when you get down to the atomic, subatomic particle level, you should be able to see these little particles with only north or south poles. And they're really weird little things. No one has actually detected these. Physicists would very much like to see them. So this year, they didn't do that. If they ever do detect a magnetic monopole, that will undoubtedly be the breakthrough of the year and Nobel Prize-winning work. But what they did was they found something that behaves just like them, only in a very different system. Now, this sort of mock monopole, as we're calling it, they take place in a kind of a material called a spin ice, which is a magnetic crystal with certain properties that can propagate little ripples through itself called quasi-particles. They're quasi because they're not real particles, but they behave like particles. And if you look at these things in the right way, they have properties that they would expect, that all the theorists predict a magnetic monopole would have. They behave just like them, but they're very different sorts of things. So in physics, very often, when you can't find what you're looking for, you try to model it in some other system so you could study it even if you don't really have it. And that's what they've done this year.
And this is a real thing, this spin ice, a physical thing. This isn't theory we're talking about here.
Yeah, no, they're actual materials. They have names like holmium titanate and dysprosium titanate. And they have crystal structures and all the other things. They are real things. This falls into the pure knowledge category. It's a real feat of physics. It's beautiful physics. It's classical physics. No quantum weirdness involved. And we decided that, you know, for that reason alone, it deserved to be a breakthrough.
Okay. So next up, another real material, graphene. What's the breakthrough here? Graphene was invented in 2004 first?
Yes, graphene's been around for a while. Now, what graphene is, it's little sheets of carbon atoms, one atom thick, and they're arranged in this sort of hexagonal structure that looks like chicken wire. And the reason that physicists like them is that they have amazing electrical properties. Electrons can move through graphene really quickly. So that makes them very good for a couple things. One thing, they can study a lot of theoretical things that they love to be able to find out more about. But these also have possible practical applications. It is conceivable, in fact, it's more than likely, I'd say, that graphene will be useful for electronics. And the only barrier to that so far has been they haven't been able to make enough of it. It's very hard to make.
So is that the breakthrough this year?
The real breakthrough this year is that they've finally been able to make enough of it to do experiments with and to build little electronic devices. Now, you're not going to see them in, you know, iPods anytime really soon, but at least the physicists can study them now and work on them and see how they'll work.
How big are these graphene sheets that they've made, and what's a characteristic of graphene that they've discovered this year?
Well, we call them sheets. They're actually more like flecks. They're about a centimeter on a side, little squares. They grow them on copper foils, and they've been able to make them into little devices, such, for example, a transistor that can switch on and off 26 billion times a second. They've built another kind of device called a frequency multiplier. They've developed a little scale that can weigh molecules. I mean, they're just making all sorts of little neat things with this graphene. So we decided to mark the year in which graphene really took off. But, you know, this isn't the last you're going to be hearing about it. You're going to be hearing about graphene every year from now on.
Okay. Well, from something we'll be hearing about every year from now on to something we've been hearing about every year for the past two decades, the Hubble. This year, they've updated the Hubble, and it has earned a place as a breakthrough. Why is that?
Well, one reason this is a breakthrough is that it was a virtually flawless shuttle mission. It's the last shuttle servicing mission to fly to the Hubble Space Telescope. And people may not know this, but Hubble was in real trouble for a while there. The last servicing mission, which was planned in 2004, got canceled. And then there were budget cuts and the shuttles couldn't fly. And so a lot of people weren't sure that they'd ever get up there to fix the Hubble. Some people were arguing for just letting it drop. But NASA decided that it would send the shuttle astronauts back up to fix it. And they did a superb job. They installed a new camera, the wide field camera number 3, which had 10 times the resolution of the previous one. So it gets 10 times as sharp a picture. They put in a new spectrograph to study light rays that can tell you what things are made of. And they upgraded some of the existing devices. So they just gave it a complete overhaul, and now Hubble is taking better pictures and gathering better data than ever before.
Okay. Well, from imaging things far afield to imaging something up really close, our Moon and the L-Cross mission earns a spot as a breakthrough of the year. What happened with this mission?
We bombed the Moon. You probably remember this. It happened back in October. October 9th, NASA sent a spacecraft up and let its rocket stage crash into the Moon in a crater called Cabeus near the Moon's south pole, while this other spacecraft watched and saw what it threw up in the explosion.
What were scientists looking for?
Water.
Why?
Well, they kind of suspect that it had to be there, you know? One thing people don't realize is that some of the craters at the lunar poles are some of the coldest places in the universe. And although you don't think of the Moon as being a particularly wet place, if any water ever did end up there, like from a comet crashing into it or something, it would probably stay there in the little shadowy craters where the rims cast permanent shadows. That water's not going anywhere. So they decided to go and look whether it was actually there. Now, there are possible practical applications for this. For example, if astronauts were ever going to set up a permanent lunar base, they would need raw materials to work with. And one of the most important ones is water. You need it to drink. You can make rocket fuel out of it. And the thinking was that if you could find some of that stuff on the Moon itself and process it right there, then you wouldn't have to carry it all up there with you. And that would make it easier to have a permanent human habitation up there. The catch is that it would be really hard to do that because it's 40 degrees above absolute zero in those craters. And so far, we don't know if people can actually work under those conditions. So they're going to have to develop a lot of new technology if they're ever going to mine the water from the Moon and melt it down and drink it and turn it into things. But at least now we know it's there.
Do we have any idea how much of it is there? Do we think it's just in these shadows of these craters or scattered throughout the Moon?
Well, you may remember other results that found that there were water or water-like molecules pretty much all over the place, not very much of it. And a lot of it is bound to other minerals where it would be really hard to squeeze out. But it does turn out that, you know, from the solar wind, there's hydrogen. They're the right materials to make water in the solar wind that's hitting the moon. Nothing to stop it. On Earth, you've got magnetic fields and things screening us from the solar wind, and the moon just gets it full blast. A lot of those things just go right into the minerals on the moon, and they make water. Comets and asteroids that contain water hit the moon and leave little bits of themselves behind. And in fact, in some of the water that they found at the lunar South Pole, they also found other molecules that you would expect to find in icy asteroids and in comets. So chances are that over billions of years, these things have been crashing into the moon, bringing water with them, and some of that water has managed to hang on there.
Okay. So we know that none of these other runners-up have any particular order. It's not like the 10th or the 9th or the 8th. But I understand that this next story, which is about the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, is decidedly the number one runner-up, the second place, if you will, to our breakthrough of the year. What makes this such a breakthrough?
Yeah, I would say this one really does stand out from the pack. Basically, what you've got here is a whole new frequency range in which astronomers can look at the sky in a way they haven't done before.
Something new about this telescope that makes it so much better than past attempts to look at gamma rays?
Yes, there have been gamma ray telescopes before. There have been several of them on the ground, and there was even one in orbit, the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which was up during the 1990s. But this new one, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, is a lot more sensitive. And it can see things that they can't see from the ground and that they couldn't see from orbit before.
What are they seeing?
Well, one thing they're seeing is pulsars. Now, pulsars are these amazing cosmic objects. They're neutron stars, which are incredibly dense matter that's left over after you have a supernova explosion. And all the matter scrunches down and all the protons and the electrons combine and just get this big ball of neutrons that's the densest matter in the universe. And it spins around like crazy. And as it spins, it shoots out these jets of energy, which we can see. We see them as flickers because they come out of the poles of the pulsar. And as these things spin around, they sweep across us. And so we see flashes of this very high energy light that hits us. So when astronomers first saw these things a couple of generations ago, they thought that they might be signals from intelligent life. Now they know that they're not, but they're still remarkable things, and they're just dying to find ways to study them. Well, it turns out that these things give out gamma rays, too. Gamma rays are the highest energy kind of radiation. You know, you get visible light, then ultraviolet, then X-rays, and then gamma rays, which are just the most energetic electromagnetic waves there are. And it's just a new way of looking at the sky.
So they're traveling immense distances, and that's why you need the higher sensitivity?
Some of these things are, but, you know, some of them are not really that far away on a cosmic scale. I think this year, for example, they found 16 new pulsars just from their gamma rays alone. And the most distant one is just under 3,000 light years, I think, which isn't that far away on a cosmic scale. They're all inside our galaxy.
What else besides pulsars?
Well, they're seeing a lot of other things besides pulsars in the gamma ray spectrum. In fact, so far, Fermi has detected more than 1,300 gamma ray sources. And in addition to the pulsars, they include these things called starbursting galaxies, which are galaxies that are just making stars like crazy. And they found gamma ray bursts, which are these incredibly energetic explosions out in space, and nobody really knows exactly where they come from, and they've looked at black holes. So the whole cosmic zoo they're looking at in the gamma ray spectrum now. So if they combine this gamma ray data with all the other data that they're gathering from all the different telescopes and all the different wavelengths, then they'll figure out how things work, how the individual objects, and perhaps they'll get some big global view of the universe as a whole and manage to test things like theories of relativity that they haven't been able to test so far.
Robert Kuntz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally, we're to the breakthrough of the year, Ardipithecus ramidus, the most detailed picture of early hominid life. Here's Science Contributing News editor Elizabeth Collada.
Ardipithecus ramidus is truly a breakthrough because it is so rare to find such an ancient hominin skeleton that's associated. And what's key here is that it is an associated skeleton. That is, we have pieces of Ardipithecus from her toes to the top of her head. She was, by the way, she stood about 120 centimeters tall. If you looked at her, you wouldn't think early human. You would probably think ape, because she looked like a primitive ape. She is a window into our earliest past, and we have not really had very much of a view of what was going on in our history way back then. We've had bits and pieces. We have a skull, and we have a thigh bone from even older than Ardipithecus, but Ardipithecus is our first really good look at what was going on very early in our history. She is 4.4 million years old. And until Ardipithecus, the oldest hominid skeleton was Lucy, who is a million years younger at 3.2 million years.
Compared to Lucy, then, what's new? What have scientists learned that's new about our earliest ancestors?
Oh my goodness, a lot is new. Ardipithecus does not look like Lucy, nor does Ardipithecus look like a chimpanzee. And some people had thought that our earliest ancestors might have looked something like a chimpanzee, since, after all, chimpanzees are our closest living relatives. Ardipithecus looks nothing like either of those. She's an unexpected and odd mosaic. Probably nobody would have predicted what she looks like. She walked upright at least some of the time, and they know that from her pelvis. The top of her pelvis is arranged so that she can balance on one leg at a time. Also, she carried her head upright like we do. If you think of a cat or a dog, they're on four legs and they kind of have their head down in a certain way. Ardipithecus stood upright and carried her head upright like we do. However, she had an opposable toe. So not a thumb, but a toe. And she had that opposable toe to grasp branches so that she spent a lot of time in the trees. So she was walking along in the trees carefully, and she was probably also upright on the ground sometimes. So she is much more primitive than Lucy, who's probably spent much less time in the trees. And Lucy walked upright much more like we do. I mean, if you saw Lucy walk, you would begin to see that you're getting on towards what a human looks like. With Ardipithecus, we're really looking at something much more primitive and much more ape-like. Ardipithecus takes us back to what has been a very mysterious time in our history. We haven't known very much about it.
So is this the kind of breakthrough then that's going to happen whenever scientists find an older hominin, at least one that's associated where all the bits and pieces fit together?
Well, that's just it. It's very rare for scientists to find a skeleton that's associated with all the bits and pieces fitting together. Now, by the way, Ardipithecus isn't perfectly complete. They don't have every single bone, but they have a lot of it. And in particular, they have the hands, the feet, the pelvis, the skull, and many other pieces. Although they don't have every single bone, they don't have every vertebrae, for example. But it's not an ordinary find in any way because it's associated. There are only, if you start at, say, 2 million years ago, there are only three other hominin skeletons that are that old. One of them has hardly even been published. One is Lucy, and now there's Ardi. And Ardi is the oldest hominin skeleton that we know of. So it's very, very rare to find an associated skeleton. We do have fossil hominins, and that's hominin means humans and our ancestors, the line that led to humans. We do have fossil hominins that are older than Ardi. There is a skull from Chad that's 6 million years old, and there's a thigh bone that's also older than Ardi, but they're not associated. You don't really know what the rest of those animals look like. And interestingly, Ardi resembles some of those older hominins a bit. And so Ardi can be used as sort of a Rosetta Stone to look at these fragmentary other fossils and really begin to see what our earliest history was like.
At this point, we're a few months since the publication of the scientific papers on Ardipithecus remedus. What's been the reaction of the scientific community thus far?
Well, first of all, I think it was wow, and at last, because people have been waiting for 15 years for this skeleton to be published. It was found back in the mid-1990s, and they published little bits of it, but Ardipithecus remedus was in very poor condition. The bones are so brittle and fragile that if you touch them, they collapse. So it took them a long time to very carefully excavate every piece, glue it back together, preserve it. And what they did was they digitally analyzed and scanned many pieces of the bone and put some of them back together in the computer rather than physically. And so all of this took a long time. So everyone has been kind of awaiting this skeleton for a very long time. And so many people are very relieved and happy to see it. However, not everyone agrees, actually, that Ardipithecus is necessarily a hominin. Everybody agrees that she has certain traits in her skull and teeth that suggest that she's a hominin. But some people aren't quite sure about the upright walking. She's so primitive, and she probably didn't spend all of her time upright, so they're not quite sure that she meets the criteria for hominin-like upright walking. However, even those who aren't convinced that she's a hominin agree that Ardipithecus is really important. from now on, when people think about some of the most fundamental questions about early human evolution, for example, when did we start walking upright? How can you tell a hominin when you go far back, when you go back more than 3 million years ago? How can you tell what a hominin looked like? When you start asking those questions, even if you don't agree with the answers made by Ardipithecus discoverers, you will still be referring to Ardi.
Elizabeth Culotta, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Elizabeth Culotta on Ardipithecus ramidus, the 2009 breakthrough of the year. You can read more about all of the breakthroughs this year, as well as see a special video about Ardipithecus ramidus online at www.sciencemag.org/BTOY2009. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, we'll have a special Science Now podcast next week with a wrap-up of the favorite science stories from the year. In the meantime, you can catch up on the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the December 18th, 2009 special Science Magazine podcast on the breakthroughs of the year. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.